license plate, license plate. Every state has a license plate. I'll detect them, I'll collect them, I'll collect every license plate.
I've never heard that before. It was a history-making time 35 years ago this month when state officials unveiled the design of an all-new license plate in advance of the Washington State Centennial Celebration. Our resident historian Felix Bunnell tracked down the high school senior whose enduring design beat out nearly 1,400 other artists. Felix is brought to us by the Lake Washington Windows and Doors.
Morning, Dave. Yeah, it was back in May 1986. Eric Booth was a student at Ferndale High School in Whatcom County. One afternoon, the phone rang. His mom hollered for him, and he came and took the cordless handset from her and placed it to his ear. The caller was Teresa Aragon, head of the Washington State Department of Licensing.
And she's like, "Hi, Eric. Do you remember entering this contest?" So I'm kind of like, "Yeah." And she said, "You won." And I immediately was just like flying around the house. She was talking to me, asking me questions, and I was like, "You've got to be kidding me." I literally, my face went kind of pins and needles. The adrenaline was pumping, and all I remember from that conversation was something like, "You won. We want to bring you down to Olympia, blah, blah, blah. State Patrol car will come and get you. Where's your family?"
So the centennial was in 1989. It's 100 years since Washington became a state. The contest to design the license plate was held a few years before that, in 1986, and now the origins of the contest and the idea of making a special plate trace back a bit before that, to former Secretary of State Ralph Monroe and a visit he made to his elderly father on Bainbridge Island.
And he went out in the garage and he pulled out a 1939 license plate from the state of Washington, and he said, "You should have a license plate." This was the 1939 license plate for the Golden Jubilee. And so we got this license plate idea, and I started to promote it, and others talked about it. We thought, "Yeah, it's a great idea. Let's have a license plate."
So that was the one sign that Washington had a special plate before, for the 50th anniversary of statehood, mm-hmm. back in 1939. So there's a direct link between 1939 and 1989, which I think is pretty cool. Now, Eric Booth had always drawn cars and band logos, and he was in the early stages of choosing a career in graphic design when his art teacher encouraged him to enter the contest, which he says he did on the last possible day. And the plate design he submitted, which we'll talk about in a minute, had a silhouette of Mount Rainier and the words "Centennial Celebration." After that phone call, it all happened pretty fast. The official unveiling was in late May at the state capitol. Late former Governor Booth Gardner was there, and so was Secretary of State Ralph Monroe, who was in charge of the whole centennial celebration. Eric was there with his mom and dad. They had, in fact, been driven from Ferndale to Olympia by the state patrol. They gave him a plaque with a copy of the plate, and the media coverage was intense, as you could imagine, which meant that young Eric soon learned that his design was not exactly universally admired.
And I remember the headline was, "New license plate, you love or you hate." And, of course, the people who loved it were the housewives and the people with blue or red vans, minivans, who thought, "You know, I love it. It's going to match my car." And then we had, you know, people who were professional graphic designers who were kind of like, they hated it. They thought it was amateurish. It looked contrived. Of course, I remember all of this now like it was yesterday. It's just kind of stuck with me my entire career.
You know, and despite the critics, winning the contest did influence his career. He's now principal interaction designer with Pitney Bowes in Connecticut. And the centennial plate was popular with the public, too. It was available from 1987 to 1990. And what made the winning design stand out is that it's very colorful. It's not the green that you might have been expected for a Washington plate. It's red and blue. And, of course, it also has that Mount Rainier silhouette. And that silhouette and those colors were kept after the centennial celebration was over, which is a little unusual. So Eric's design is currently visible on more than 7.5 million plates here in 2021.
Wow.
Now, Eric Booth can't remember exactly how he was inspired to go with Mount Rainier, but he remembers how he drew it so accurately.
My dad was working in Tacoma at the time, and I literally was looking out the window and just kind of traced it. And so a couple of my original designs, I was doing the shading and doing all that stuff. And I was like, nobody's going to be able to see the shading. They're not even going to be able to print the shading. So I just came up with a thing where I could block it out, you know. But I was literally, I was visiting him at his office down there. And if you're thinking about it, it's the Tacoma view of the mountain.
One more reason for Tacoma to feel superior to Seattle.
Yes.
So 35 years later, Eric says family and friends still remember his role in designing the plate. And it comes up in those icebreaker games, you know, something you don't know about me kinds of things you do, and then you start new jobs and that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
He said that he sees the plates occasionally near where he lives now in Connecticut. But one particular place where a Washington plate is on display made a big impression.
I had a friend, actually, who was, like, visiting the Smithsonian. This one kind of blew me away. And they've got the preamble, "We the People," done in kind of customized license plates. And my license plate design is there. And that one kind of is like, of all of the places where people have kind of said, hey, Eric, I saw your plate, that was the one that kind of threw me back the most. I was like, damn, that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I think they picked the right plate and the right guy. He's humble, but it's clear he's still really jazzed by the honor of having his design selected.
Probably every time I look at a license plate, I'm probably thinking about it in the back of my head. Do I dwell on it? Every time I do think about it, though, I think about how lucky I am. That's, you know, if it had just come and gone in a few years and people would be like, you know what, no big deal. To me, I think the thing that stands out the most is really just the length of time.
Yeah, that is pretty incredible. And the state wasn't able to tell me just how many of Eric's plates in total have been made over the past 34 years. I mean, if there's 7.5 million out there right now, it's got to be, I don't know, 20, 30 million?
Huge.
I mean, some tens of millions of these plates are out there. And what artist can point to that a piece of artwork and say, you know, this many millions are out there in metal? Now, I had to ask him if he ever got to see the factory in Walla Walla where the plates are made by Department of Corrections inmates.
No, I didn't get to see it. But, you know, my dad, being the dad he is, I inherited his dad jokes. He used to always say, you know, my son designed the plate. He's not making them.
And I talked to Eric's parents, Roger and Connie, and they're just as proud as you expect. And Eric, he still has his copy of the original Centennial plate that he ordered for himself, a personalized plate that says my design on it. And we'll have a gallery up later at My Northwest with all kinds of great pictures of the images of the plates that he's collected, plates he's been inspired by. And it is really unusual because other states have had special plates for their centennials or other kinds of special occasions. But the fact the core design remains, what is it, 34 years later, 35 yeah. years after it was like, that's really bizarre.
Well, and I mean, if you're going to choose an icon, you can't do better than Mount Rainier, right?
Yeah, they really did a nice job. And the contest was a real success. They picked the right plate and the right guy.
Right. Felix Bedell, all his features are available at MyNorthwest.com. And if you're new to town and don't know what Mount Rainier looks like, it's out this morning, by the way. You just look to the southeast. You'll see the license plate.
I always get it mixed up with Mount Pilchuck. It's
yes,
easy to
do. Easy to do. Felix Bedell. Thanks, Felix.
Thanks, Dave.
This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. With the new tax deadline of May 17th approaching, I thought it would be an excellent time to talk once again to our tax whisperer, Don DeSantis of Clifton Larson Allen. Deadline is May 17th, and I thought this was interesting, Don. The IRS commissioner threw out a figure that tax cheats are costing the United States Treasury $1 trillion a year. Now, I knew that people were getting away with stuff, but $1 trillion a year, that sounds rather high. So what are the implications of that?
Well, Dave, I heard that story recently as well. That's from Charles Reddick, the current IRS commissioner. Reddick testified before Congress here just very recently, and he threw out this number that he said could be up to $1 trillion. And I think it was kind of it staggered a lot of people. Nobody expected to hear a number like that.
So what do they do about it? I understand that they've been understaffed for some time in terms of audits. In fact, isn't the audit percentage lower than it's ever been?
Oh, the audit percentages have been dropping dramatically over the last 10 years or so. And, you know, the chance for just an individual, and I'm not talking about a super wealthy person, I'm saying kind of the average person, 1040, the chance of getting audited is like less than 0.5%.
Which is pretty low. And the reason I'm interested in this $1 trillion tax cap is that $1 trillion, that's, well, it's about half the cost of Biden's infrastructure plan. And it strikes me that he's talking about raising taxes, right, to pay for that. If they could just get people to pay the taxes they owed, you wouldn't have to raise taxes nearly as much. So it would seem to me, wouldn't it be wise for the IRS to hire at least a few extra auditors and try to capture some of that money?
Okay, well, let's look at a couple of numbers here. From 2010 to 2018, the IRS budget dropped 20%, and their number of staff dropped 22%, or about 17,000 people. Recently, in the testimony before Congress, Reddick said that if we could have $1 billion more a year, I could hire roughly 5,000 new auditors. Now, what's interesting is that just recently, like just in the last day or two, and we're probably going to hear more about it with Biden's new tax proposals, he is supposedly coming out with a proposal to raise the IRS budget $80 billion over 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
He's talking about increasing their funding over 2/3.
That's pretty big.
It's pretty big.
Now, we're not talking about stopping people from getting the legal deductions that they're owed. We're talking about people who are either lying or trying to take a deduction that isn't allowed. So maybe you should explain the difference between tax avoidance and tax evasion.
Okay. There's a very famous jurist from the early part of the 20th century, and you're going to laugh when I mention his name, but he was Judge Learned Hand.
Yes, I've heard of him.
You've heard of him. Okay. Well, he has a very famous ruling, and basically what he says is that everybody has the right to plan, you know, their affairs to reduce their taxes to the lowest legal amount, and that nobody is under any obligation to pay the IRS the highest amount of money. And so consequently, it's totally fine to arrange transactions, to arrange things in such a way that you get the lowest legal amount of tax. And that's called tax avoidance. You can avoid paying taxes by planning ahead of time.
Mm-hmm.
Tax evasion, though, is different. Tax evasion is, look, you've engaged in some transactions. The facts are basically set. And what you're trying to do is either manipulate the facts or distort them or just outright hide things so you don't pay the tax. That's evasion. Evasion's illegal.
Right. So tax avoidance is like, not cashing in your capital gains until after you've retired to a lower income tax bracket, for example.
Sure. But that's just an example of tax planning. What can I do legally that allows me to reduce my tax now?
Okay. Cryptocurrency. What if you start taking your income in cryptocurrency, which presumably is not being reported to anybody?
Well, note the last year or two, there's a question on a Form 1040 now that says, did you engage in any cryptocurrency transactions during the year?
Mm-hmm.
Because certainly if you make money in cryptocurrency, it's reportable just like anything else. The current IRS commissioner said what he'd like to do is hire specialized auditors, because it's not the person who goes to work every day, gets paid with a W-2 and comes home who's generally avoiding their taxes.
Right.
But if you engage in transactions where there's not 1099s or W-2s or K-1 forms, it's a lot easier.
Well, I'm not suggesting people do this, but suppose they just lie on the cryptocurrency question.
That's breaking the law.
Right.
And that gets to this question of, is the IRS five steps behind? You know, maybe there's new tools they need, some new IRS regulations, new tax law.
How far back can they go to learn whether or not you lied?
Well, the general statute of limitations is 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So once it's been 3 years after you filed your return, whether you made a mistake, the IRS had made a mistake, it's history. Now, if you've intentionally engaged in transactions, hiding things, if you created fraud, there is no statute of limitations.
Uh-huh.
The IRS could go back forever on those.
Okay, so the deadline is May 17th. If you had a cryptocurrency transaction and made some money on it, you're supposed to report it. And if you lie, there is no statute of limitations.
If you commit fraud, there's no statute of limitations on that.
All right. Don DeSantis, our tax whisperer from Clifton Larson Allen. Thanks very much, Don.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
A surprise announcement from Governor Inslee on the next phase of the COVID response. And I think it was a welcome surprise. Here's Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott.
After days of agonizing over which counties were going to roll back, which might stay put, businesses making various accommodations, expecting the worst, Inslee had this announcement to make.
Today I'm announcing a 2-week pause on our phased reopening plan. This means all counties for the next 2 weeks will stay in the current phase that they're in this morning. At the end of the 2-week pause, we will evaluate the metrics at that time. The number of cases per 100,000, the hospitalizations. So this is not a change to the phase plan, but we are pausing it for 2 weeks as we continue to evaluate the changing conditions in the state of Washington.
That's right. No counties would roll back, at least not for the next 2 weeks. So why the pause?
Because we are in a constantly evolving situation, and unlike any other time during the pandemic, we look at the most recent information literally on a daily basis to make these decisions. For the past several weeks, epidemiologists have observed a fourth wave developing of COVID, as I talked about last week. But the most recent data that has come in just in the last few days, including what DOH has observed over the weekend, shows a potential plateauing of the COVID activity in the state of Washington, which obviously is good news.
But it's not all good news.
We've unfortunately had increased hospitalizations. Fortunately, the death rate has gone down dramatically since we started the vaccine effort, and we're very, very happy about that. We attribute these changes to our vaccination progress. There's a reason we're succeeding on this, is because not only have we acted safely, but we're getting shots into arms.
So here's where things stand.
So we're at the intersection of progress and failure, and we cannot veer from the path of progress. Our economy is starting to show early signs of growth. We've had great legislative victories on a number of issues. And we know vaccines are the ticket to full reopening. And we're very pleased about the success to date in that regard.
Right now, just about 40% of the state has been fully vaccinated. Governor Inslee wants to see that number go up.
We need to continue to those efforts. There is reason to have hope that if we were to continue our progress on vaccinations, that sometime in the summer, we could potentially have much more normal activities in our state. But this is dependent on our continuing to increase the vaccination rates. And as you know, we've had some concern about that in the last week or two.
King County Health Officer Dr. Jeff Duchin acknowledging that his county would have had to roll back without this pause.
In assessing the trajectory of our outbreak and considering response measures, both the number of cases and hospitalizations and the direction of our trend, whether we are rising or falling, are important. Although King County has exceeded the previously announced phase two rollback metrics, the recent increase in the number of cases in King County has leveled off for approximately 2 weeks now and is no longer rising at this time. We've also seen a plateau last week in our emergency department visits for COVID-like illness. And although it's not possible to predict with certainty where we're headed next, in many other areas of the country that experienced the COVID-19 fourth wave, cases have been declining.
Duchin is normally very conservative with his reopening decisions, but said this two-week pause makes sense, as does keeping the county in phase three.
A two-week pause recognizes new information about our local disease trends and provides time to see more reliably which direction we're heading in and whether we're turning the corner on the fourth wave, which we very well may be. While we continue to do everything we possibly can to get more people vaccinated, especially younger adults, to decrease our future risk. I think this is a good, and I know a difficult decision by the governor, to make these late changes in response to the rapidly evolving situation.
Now, this is not the first time Inslee has moved the goalpost on phases and reopenings, and he was grilled by reporters yesterday, including Cairo 7 TV's Essex Porter.
Good morning, Governor. You've been touching on this, but in our newsroom, we've just received a text from one of the restaurant owners who says he just changed the rules again. How can we trust the process?
Well, I hope that restaurant is happy that I changed the rules again so he can stay at 50%. I can't believe he wouldn't believe that was a good thing. So really happy that we've changed the rules to allow restaurant owners to stay open at 50%. I have to believe that would be a popular position with the restaurant industry. Now, he can stay at 25% if he'd like. That's his decision. I'm not making him do so. So we think this would be well received.
Q13's Brandy Cruz followed up with this exchange.
As for the gratitude restaurant owners should feel for today's decision that you referenced when Essex asked you a question, you know, we know that planning for ups and downs for restaurants is hard. It takes time. And there was no indication before 11 a.m. today that you would change your mind. There was no indication 3 weeks ago that you were going to change your mind on the metrics until the last minute. So what do you say to skeptics who see all of this as just completely arbitrary?
I am fully aware of the difficulties that people have in this situation. If you're trying to plan how much food to order or plan your staffing, it is a challenge to have these changes. There is no way to diminish the difficulty that the businesses have in that regard. But you have to make a decision. Are you going to save lives and accept some of those difficulties or not? We've made a decision to save lives. And as far as the issue of, well, we didn't get advance notice, look, there's always a decision where you make a decision, and until you make a decision and announce it, you can't give advance notice. If you give advance notice, that's when you've made the decision.
So I guess you can't win here. So you're yeah. Was the vibe was that people were upset even though they now get to stay open?
There was some of that, yes. And I think just in my own personal discussions with some restaurant owners, that there's kind of mixed. Some were very much relieved that this was going to allow them to stay at their 50% capacity, as well as salons and, you know, gyms and all of those types of businesses. But there are those businesses who, you know, I would say probably business owners who some kind of had that ideology already, where they have a, kind of been a critic of the governors throughout this entire process since the pandemic began. But others, just based on kind of their makeup, you know, their smaller staff, they let people go every time we have to go back a phase, and they, right. you know, cut down on their staffing and their orders for food and their supplies and all of that. And it gets to be a problem for them. Some are just annoyed with the entire process. Others, right. though, who moved when we moved to phase three, one bar owner that I know said it didn't make any difference that they were still at the same capacity based on spacing that they had to do anyway. So some people just aren't affected either way.
Well, I mean, do you think there's any point in the state being involved in this anymore? Other than making sure that there's vaccine available for everybody, which I think there is. I've seen drugstores are reorganizing themselves now. I mean, it's been ramped up. You're seeing individual physicians now getting it. As I said, I went on to you know, Biden's text message service there, and I suddenly find out this little doctor's office just a mile away from me, it too has vaccines. So at this point, it's a choice. And yes. and restaurants are also free if they want to insist on cards to make things double, super, triple safe, because they already have the plastic screens and the masks and everything else. I mean, right. What's left for the state to do here?
You know, maybe organize and be the legal word, I suppose. But I think we're still technically in an emergency. And I would say that the local health departments could probably handle anything that needed handled. Tough to say, though. You still have Ferry County, which the governor mentioned yesterday, and the super spreader event. Folks right. like that who were not following some of the rules.
I mean, our hospitals filling up. I mean, the UW has even stopped covering available hospital facilities because we never even got close to capacity, at least in this wave, as far as I can tell.
No, and we really, I don't know that we got really close to capacity, except maybe the first time around with the first wave. So I think maybe just from an organizational standpoint, but you have to make sure they still sound like they're maybe not 100% certain on how things are going to play out. I will say this, I think that this 2-week pause is really the governor's telling people, here's your chance to get your vaccines, because we aren't where he wants us to be. There's not enough of us who are getting vaccinated. There's too much hesitancy. And yeah, I think if you don't see that change, then perhaps we do see more rollbacks.
What ends vaccine hesitancy is seeing what happens when one of your friends gets it. And yes, I think a lot of people are finding that out now. So I just don't, like I said, I don't know what more that they can do. All right, Hannah, thank you very much.
I was thinking
that
this morning.
Yep, exactly. Yep.
Your Daily Dose of Kindness now brought to you by Robert W. Baird & Company, Incorporated. A chance encounter with a stranger and her dog brought comfort to a grieving little girl. And CBS's Steve Hartman tells us how the healing power of a puppy and kindness will hopefully lead to a lifelong friendship.
According to her mother, Lacey, 6-year-old Raylin Nast of Fort Smith, Arkansas, has always been a daddy's girl.
She was very proud of her dad. She always wanted to introduce her dad to just about anybody.
Until a couple weeks ago, when her father, Davey, died of colon cancer. He was just 41, and Raylin was just devastated.
It was a cry that was pure heartbreak.
Enter Emily Beineman, who happened to be jogging with her dog, Blue, the day of the visitation. She was running past the funeral home when all of a sudden she heard a tiny voice call out from the chapel steps.
She was like, "May I pet your puppy?" And I was like, "Yeah, like of course, like as long as your parents don't mind."
That's what you said to her?
Yeah.
Not knowing,
yeah.
Raylin explained that her dad was lying inside, gave Blue a huge hug, and then gave Emily a stunning invitation.
I asked her if she wanted to come in and see my dad.
That's right. This still proud daughter invited that random jogger to meet her father.
Emily was hardly dressed for a funeral, and she knew just walking in the door would cause a scene.
But she also knew this was the last time that little girl would be able to introduce her daddy to anyone. So she followed her gut and followed Raylynn down the aisle.
Everyone was kind of looking around, like, where did she come from? And she came in right next to Ray, like they'd known each other for so long. There was that connection there.
How could two people bond so quickly?
She helped me feel better.
Raylynn says it should be no mystery.
By her kindness.
Raylynn and Emily got together again this week and plan to stay friends forever.
Sweet.
Of course, no one will ever replace her dad. But Raylynn is clearly on the path to a better place.
Yes.
Thanks to the kindness of a stranger and the healing power of a warm puppy. Steve Hartman, on the road, in Fort Smith, Arkansas.
Oh my gosh, I can't even go on with the broadcast now.
I know. It's one of his best, and...
Yikes.
Oh, what can you say?
Still dabbing my eyes after the dose of kindness.
Aww.
I'm going to have to keep a towel. I'm going to keep a towel now.
You weren't alone. We got a text, too, on the text line. Actually, a couple, and one of them was, I'm a grown man, a trucker, you know, big and tough. That last story tore me apart. I was tearing up bad, and I just wrote back, you are not alone.
Anyway, from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon, here's G Scott.
Good morning.
Hi. So, last year saw the largest decline in the U.S. birth rate since the 60s, and everybody's trying to figure out why. So, what's your theory?
It's easy. First of all, the younger generation, they're smarter than we are. And
come
we
on.
Were. And I'm gonna keep it really simple. Do you remember, if you're listening right now, do you remember the first time that you went to go find out how much child care would be? And remember the feeling that you got of, wait, what? How much is it a month? You see, so many of that happened. And now the younger generation said, I know the price of child care. I'm going to wait until I am able to have a good career. I'm going to wait until both me and my significant other, we have a house and all, whatever it is that you want to wait for.
They're going to be waiting a long time.
Hey, Colleen, you just said you're going to be waiting a long time. Then
yeah.
now you just answered the question why yep. there's been such a pause. Folks yep. are waiting. Folks are knowing. Like, I mean, wait, who you mean to tell me that I had no idea that child care would be as much as a mortgage? Nobody ever didn't tell you that in high school.
Yeah.
More than a mortgage in some situations.
Like a high-end private school.
You know what I'm saying? So that is really the reason as to why what's going on. And it costs money. It costs money to raise children. So that is the reason for the pause. A lot of families, some folks are waiting to get married. You know, some folks are having kids in their 30s, waiting till they're financially secure. I just think the days of just getting right out of high school and having children, that's not going to be as much as it used to be.
My second child wasn't a decision of desire. It was a decision of, can I afford to give this child the life I want to give them? Mm. So it's not so much like, I want to grow up and I want to have three kids and fulfilling that dream. It's, okay, let's have a first. Okay, that turned out okay. Okay, now let's do some calculations. Can we? And I think it's smarter that way, because why bring up a child if you cannot support them in the current atmosphere? It's irresponsible. Mm-hmm. You're going to strap your child with your debt.
Mm-hmm. I got to think, Colleen, hearing you saying that, there's going to be some children named Financial, right? Like, hey, why is your name Financial? Oh, because my parents, they were financially able to have me. Oh, okay, I got it. So,
well, I guess our family was started sort of on the cusp of everybody just assuming it'd be a two-income family. I was kind of hoping it'd be a two-income family, and you know, we had sort of this spoken deal: I'll work till I'm 40, and then you'll take over and work. That never worked out.
That
also meant that we didn't pay that much for daycare because my wife stayed home.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's what it comes down to, why you see so many people out of the workforce. A lot of women I know, it was like, okay, well, we know women are paid less than men in many circumstances. You have your kids and you go, oh my gosh, the cost of childcare. Well, you have the lower paying job. you also, you know, have the societal norm of staying home. So you find women leaving the job market simply because they can't afford childcare against what they make in their salary, which to me is so sad. If now, you choose to stay home, love it. I was raised by a mother who stayed home, and I'm better for it. But yeah, if you want to work but can't afford because of children, that's a tragedy to me.
Can I just want to leave on a selfish note, because for some reason I feel like being selfish. Right now, my youngest just turned 18, so that means he's allowed to go and earn for himself. And my oldest, of course, is out there in college, and he gets a stipend every 2 weeks. I'm telling you right now, it sure is nice when you don't have to give money to kids. Where is all this extra money coming from? So that's another reason, Colleen and Dave. There's a lot of folks that's selfish, right? They're like, wow, look
at
all this.
I was really happy after that last college tuition check went out. That was like getting a raise. G. Scott with Ursula starting at 9 on Cairo Radio. Thanks, G. You can ring my This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. And here's Rachel Bell, who was just discovered due to an article in the Wall Street Journal that millennials are unbelievably candid about how much they make.
Yes, I love this story because I'm assuming you were raised the same way that I was, that you are not supposed to ask people how much they make.
Never.
I remember specifically as a kid, my parents sitting me down and saying that when you go to someone's house, never ask what the parents made, which I don't know why I would have asked that in the first place, but I remember that being a really big deal. And I remember asking my dad how much he made, and he wouldn't even tell me what he made. So the fact that people talk about it freely now is really, really different, I think, than in years past. And the transparency, in my opinion, is really great. So I'll talk about some of the things they go through in this article, which I agree with. So just to give some stats first, in 2019, there was a survey done by creditcards.com, and they found that 61% of millennials, which at this point is, I don't know, like between 30 and 40 years old, I think, like the oldest is 40, were comfortable discussing credit card debt with their friends. And that's compared to 43% of baby boomers. And then there was a global survey by a Swedish company called Klarna. And they found that 50% of millennials believe it's important to talk about finances, only 41% of the older generation. So there's a couple of reasons for this. Number one, one theory is that since this generation has been on social media for so long, they're so used to disclosing everything about their life that there's kind of nothing off limits. There's not really a filter. But I think that they're just starting to understand that it's to their benefit. So if you don't know what any of your colleagues make or anyone in your industry, you know, maybe you just saw an article online telling you what the range is for your salary, how are you going to know that you're paid fairly?
Yeah. And there was also one woman who, when she found out what her colleagues made, decided to ask for the same from her boss. And when she didn't get it, she quit.
Yeah. And another woman who asked for a 50% raise because she got that information and actually got it. So, you know, there's no guarantee that getting that information is going to get you the raise, but I think it's still helpful to know. And there's a guy that they interviewed in this article who is a white guy who works in tech. And he said, you know, I know there are huge disparities between genders and race. So as a white man, I want to tell people what I make so that I can help level the playing field. But there is something beyond money that I really love to be transparent about, and that is Botox. There are a lot of women my age, younger and older, who get Botox. And I do not get Botox, and I have this like 11, as they call it, between my eyes now. Like I have like the crease in my forehead.
Yeah.
And I am talking to other women, friends of mine, some who are like 10 years older, and I'm looking at their face and going, where are the wrinkles? Why do I have more wrinkles and I'm 10 years younger? So sometimes, I mean, if I know them, I'll just ask, you know, do you get Botox? And when they say yes, I tell them, I'm like, oh, I'm so relieved because I was wondering what was wrong with my face. But but now I know your face looks like my face, but you've just done something about it. And that makes me feel better.
Well, I'm glad. But those are the wrinkles of wisdom, Rachel.
That they are erasing.
Yeah. And they're doing it with a toxic thing that paralyzes their muscles. I mean, why would be envious of that?
Well, I try not to be judgmental about it, even though it's not my bag, because if you're going to ask someone, especially about money or about something sensitive about, you know, if you're doing something to your face, then you can't follow up with judgment.
Yeah. Of course, that's the reason that the millennials are trying to get that raise, so they can afford the Botox to make themselves look younger.
So I had another interesting situation, and I'm curious what you think about this. So this was many years ago. I was interviewing someone for a story, and I was at their house because part of the story had to do with something in their house that they were going to show me. And this house in Seattle was unique. It was really, really interesting architecture and of a style I'd never seen before. And there were all these flourishes. And so when the guy was showing me around and, you know, I was telling him how cool the house was, I've never seen this before. And I said, do you own this place or do you rent? And he got really upset with me instantly. Really? And he snapped at me and he said, that's not your business. You should never ask someone like that. Never ask someone that, in a very angry voice. And I've been thinking about that for the last 8 years because I felt bad, but I also didn't feel like asking that was so wrong.
If that's all you're asking, own or rent, I wouldn't mind saying. If you ask like what I paid for this house, I'd be happy to tell you. If you ask how much I make, I'd say that's off limits. Why? Because I guess I was raised this. I never knew what my father made either. So I guess that's what it is. It's just too personal.
But would you share it with the colleague who asked you and framed it to say, let's say it was a woman and someone who did something similar at our job.
Yeah, yeah.
And they said, hey, Dave, I'm worried that I'm not being paid as much as the men here. Would you mind telling me what you make so that I can take that into consideration when I ask for a raise? Would you tell someone then?
I guess so. If they promised it was going to be confidential and not show up on Twitter the next day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There has to be the agreement of confidentiality. And I hope that people keep that into account. But I've experienced this in my own life. I've been noticing a lot of people being more forthcoming when you ask or when you talk about it. And it is really, really helpful for trying to get where you want to be.
Yeah. By the way, $230,000. That's what I paid for the house.
Oh, I thought that was your salary. I'm like, I thought you just said, okay.
That's what I paid for the house in 1989.
Wow. That's a good deal. I'm sure it's worth $6 billion now.
Well, it is now that I've power washed the driveway. Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.